Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
One of the storylines of this year's Olympics in Tokyo has been the journey of USA gymnast Simone Biles. Biles, widely recognized as the best gymnast in the world, many would say of all time, shocked the world by pulling out of the team competition after just one event. Biles later explained that she was experiencing what in her sport is called the twisties. Now, we're going to talk actually more in depth about what the twisties are in a moment, but the key thing to know right now is that they have to do with the way your mind works as a gymnast rather than, say, a problem with your ankle or your knee. And that has led to an intense public conversation on how we think about mental health, especially for elite athletes. Well, two licensed therapists who are local have a podcast on just that subject. It's called The Grim Drive, referring to that push to be the best always. Jotham Busfield and John Cuna are here with us to unpack both why Biles' decision has sparked such community conversation and what she teaches us for high school athletes, sports culture, and more. John and Jotham, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having us.
I'm glad to be here.
It's great to have you back. And listeners, we want you to join us as well. If you have been following this story a little or a lot, if you have thoughts or comments or questions about her decision to withdraw, what Simone Biles has been going through, what we can learn from it for our lives, our kids, our sports, call us 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Okay, now I know neither of you are gymnasts, but you're both mental health and sports experts. So can one of you explain to us, first of all, what are the twisties? Because it's important.
Yeah, so, it was a new term for me. I hadn't heard about the twisties, and sort of doing more research and listening to more people talk about it. The term that I'm more familiar with might be called like the yips. Hockey players talk about it. Baseball players talk about it. Golfers talk about it. It's sort of the prolonged presence of mental stress and fatigue when you're so heightened and focused on specific activities, and it leaves you susceptible for these types of moments. You can't trust your own mind or your own actions. And Simone spoke about that, of not knowing how she landed, or in her mind doing a different routine than what she was doing on the bar. And for someone like Simone, who I agree is probably the best of all time, doing the skills that she's doing on the beam, on the bars, on the floor, cannot be able to be in sync with what her brain and mind is telling her to do, with what her body is actually doing, leaves her extremely vulnerable for injury, physical injury, broken bones, falling off, those types of things, and leaves her in a really, really vulnerable state.
So, Jotham, before we dive sort of more generally into the conversation, I want to stay with Simone Biles for a minute, and I want to pick up on what John just said, because that seems important, that we have an athlete who is doing things that are so superhuman compared to what other people do, that the risk for superhuman injury is sort of concomitant. Have we captured that sufficiently at this point in our public conversation about the decision that she made to pull out? And if we have, how do we think about the fact that she is, in fact, going to get on a piece of wood that's no wider than my cell phone and go back, you know, doing superhuman feats on it?
That's a great question. In terms of have we grasped to a full extent of the level she's at and what she's doing, I'm not sure that most people do. And I don't know if that's necessarily their fault. I think people are kind of disconnected from the day-to-day life of someone like Simone Biles, or a gymnast, or any athlete that's reached that Mount Rushmore kind of level. I think John and I have talked about her in a past podcast where we consider her at that Mount Rushmore level, like a Michael Jordan, a Serena Williams, Tiger Woods, Tom Brady, maybe Wayne Gretzky. Those are mine. I know it's more than four, but that's who'd be on my Mount Rushmore of athletes. So I think people are, fans are just disconnected from what it really takes in the day-to-day to get to that level. They don't see that she trains 8 hours a day. They don't see that she works with a performance psychologist or with a licensed therapist as well. They don't see her mental fitness habits. So they're definitely disconnected from that in general. With regard to, her coming back, I think it's hard for us to speculate. I don't know what she's done in between the point of dropping out initially to now. I'm sure she seems like one of the things that really stands out is that she knows herself better than anybody else, and she's probably one of the hardest workers that exists. So if she thinks she's ready, I'm confident that you know, she has done or has seen whatever she needs to see within herself to feel like she's capable of competing and staying safe. I know that I'm happy for her if she wants to do that. I think the Olympics are way more fun to watch when Simone Biles performs. And that being said, her health and the health of all the athletes is always the most important thing. I think she takes that as seriously as that.
John, I want to play a little bit of Simone Biles talking about her decision to withdraw at a press conference after the team finals.
It's been a long week. It's been a long Olympic process. It's been a long year. So just a lot of different variables, and I think we're just a little bit too stressed out, but we should be out here having fun, and sometimes that's not the case.
So I have heard, you know, public reaction, John, of it's the Olympics. You're not supposed to be having fun. You're supposed to be competing for a gold medal. And every time I hear that, I think about the sign on the Little League fence near my house that says, your child is not in the MLB. These coaches are volunteers. This is supposed to be fun. And I wonder, is there something broken in our relationship between competitive sports and fun that we need to restore all the way from the Olympics down to the sandlot?
I am so excited that you're bringing up this topic, because the answer is yes. One of the core principles that I discuss with athletes when we're working through some of the programming that we do, whether it's with teams in general or individuals, is the concept of fun. We talk about like flow state or in the zone. We talk about this sort of heightened level of consciousness that athletes can get into when they are fully focused on what's going on. And fun and enjoyment and joy is a core principle to being able to access that. When there's too much stress, when there's too many things going through your head, when you're not just present, having fun in the moment, when those things are removed and replaced with, I should be doing this, I need to be doing this, oh no, that went wrong. And that's when you can start to invite the twisties or the yips, when you start second guessing yourself, doubt fills in, fear comes in. Joy and fun are the core principles. And I wasn't surprised to see the pushback from people saying, well, you're right, it's the Olympics, it's about business and do this. And I think that is the disconnect, because sports at its base is about fun. Most athletes begin playing because it was fun. They enjoyed what they were doing. And we've seen the transition in the last decade or so of athletics becoming much more business-like. It's not just at the professional level anymore that it's a business. It's trickled all the way down into the high schools. And you could make a very serious argument that it's trickled down even further than that into middle schools and even as kids are starting on. And it's something that really needs to be harped on as important. Because you'll start to see burnout with athletes, that they're competing at this business-like level at 12 to 15 years old when they really should just be focusing on joy.
So I want to turn that to listeners and invite you to call in and react. Are we in need of restoring the importance of joy in our competitive sports, whether it's, you know, third grade soccer, high school lacrosse, or all the way up to the Olympics? I really want to hear what you think about that. 1-800-423-8255 is the number. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jotham, we had one caller, Jebra from JP, who, God love her, didn't want to stay on the phone to ask her question because she was afraid she'd miss your answer in the process of hanging up and wanted to hear it. So I'm going to ask for her. She has a concern that there is this expectation that the audience owns the athlete, and therefore the athlete owes the audience a performance. And we have heard in a lot of sports this concept of ownership and pushback on the concept of ownership and whether the athlete owes the fan something. How do we think about that?
Yeah, that's a complicated topic. I mean, I think in general, sports in general, I don't know if it goes that far. I would say professional sports are a product, right? We live in a capitalist society. So this is a product that people pay for. They want to be able to consume it. So it's kind of tethered to each other, where if a fan feels like they're not getting what they deserve as a fan, then it can have that impact. I don't think in general, most people, or even the large majority of people, I would say, think of athletes like something that they own. I think fans are just irrational by nature. You know, sports are often a place for them to detach and channel raw emotion. It just is. It's one way for people to channel the stress and emotion in everyday life. So it gets thrown towards sports, gets thrown towards athletes, referees even. You know, so some fans and people are going to tear down anyone because of their own, anyone who's successful because of their own unhappiness or insecurity. But a lot of times it's just I think it ties into how fans are very irrational when it comes to their behavior.
All right. So I want to pick up some other threads here. I'm going to play a little bit of a conversation that we had with Boston Globe columnist Renee Graham earlier today. Renee has been writing about this. She's going to be with us on Week in Review on Friday. I'm sure we will talk with her more about it then. But she talked with us about how the hypocrisy has been on full display. And this one's been on my mind. She's drawn from the world of tennis and some on-court antics this past weekend from Novak Djokovic during his loss in the bronze medal game. Let's listen.
He had a complete meltdown. Like, he broke rackets, he threw rackets into the stands, and it doesn't really matter that there was nobody there to get hit. The fact was that he was so out of control and upset in that moment that, you know, he kind of lost it on the court. And we know what reactions have been when Serena Williams has, you know, behaved, and not even that badly compared to what Djokovic did, but the same idea that somehow, oh my God, she's having another meltdown and she's just bad for the game. If she can't stand the heat, she should stay out of the kitchen and all of that kind of thing. You know, Djokovic was critical of Simone Biles and essentially said, well, if you can't handle the pressure, then, you know, you're really doing the wrong thing. You don't belong in sports because that's part of the game. And we see how he handled pressure, but somehow he's allowed to do that. And we always know there's this, you know, it's not even like the goalposts move. It's like the goalposts are on wheels. You know, they just keep moving, you know, for certain people, and other people are held to a standard that is unrealistic. Again, if a Black woman had done that, we'd still be reading about it. We'd still be hearing about it. You know, Fox News would never have shut up about it. But Djokovic gets a pass on that in a way that a Black woman and most women in general, frankly, but a Black woman in particular would not. So I do think that there are, you know, there are double standards, there's triple standards for this sort of thing.
So I want to ask you both your reaction. You know, that image of the goalpost being on wheels, I kind of snorted to myself when I first heard it. And she is talking about, you know, this word intersectionality is a big complex one, but the intersection of identity here, Simone Biles is a Black American woman. And that has to be part of the conversation of her experience here. I just want to get your reactions, either of you.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, Simone Biles being Black and female absolutely plays a role for a lot of people, whether like they would like to admit it or not. You know, we did an episode on Serena Williams specifically, and the topic was Serena Williams and anger ? And what really came through in that episode was that she was unfairly sort of being linked to the whole emotion of anger. When if you look at, you know, her male counterparts, it's just they're given a free pass across the board when they have you know, temper tantrums that are indicative of a 5-year-old. Nothing's really said about them, and so there's absolutely double standard on criticisms aimed at Serena Williams, aimed at Simone Biles, that are not aimed at their male counterparts. It's very apparent. You know, some people still, whether it's conscious or unconscious, do not want to see female persons of color in positions of power. And it comes through very clearly with athletes like Simone Biles and Serena Williams.
So I want to ask listeners about that triple standard. Is that what you see here? Are the goalposts on wheels, like Boston Globe columnist Renee Graham said? And what to do about it? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So, John, there is a different subject I want to get to, too. But before I do, staying on Simone Biles and the team for just a minute longer, there was a lot of pushback that she let her team down. And then pushback on that pushback, saying that if she knew she was going to score badly, she didn't let her team down because they got a silver because they had people who were able to put forward their best performances. It's not lost on me that Novak Djokovic left and didn't compete in the medal round in mixed doubles and left his partner high and dry, and she didn't have a chance to win a medal elsewhere. What about what you owe to the team? And how to think about, in general, what we owe our teammates when we are in crisis, and frankly, what they owe us.
Yeah, one quick thing about the Novak piece, and I'll definitely touch on how athletes can rely on a single person, is, you know, the double standard comes, you know, Djokovic is seen as passionate, right? He's passionate when he's yelling and screaming and breaking rackets, and Serena is seen as angry. I think we're seeing a lot of that similar types of pieces come out now. In terms of, you know, her being able to perform and letting her teammates down, you want your best performers out there. And what you've seen, if there were any other negative side effects of Simone being able to pull out, you wouldn't have seen Soon Lee get gold. You wouldn't have seen Jade get gold. They're responding because they're in the right position, given the right circumstances. And if Simone is not ready to perform, she actually does a detriment to the team, not just to herself, but to everyone. And you want people being able to go out there and feeling confident in their abilities to be able to do so. And so I'm definitely of the camp that you should have the ability to be able to say, I'm not in the space to perform at my best right now. And I'm sure I'll get pushed back from that about even making that statement. But I firmly believe that if you are in control of what you are capable of doing, and if you are telling your teammates you're not capable, that needs to be trusted. And comments like, you know, can't handle the pressure, you don't belong in sports, I think is archaic and a little bit misguided in how things like that. And I think that's a lot of the old school approach of what, you know, people used to say in terms of, you know, just deal with it, or it's just anxiety, just push through it. It's different now than it was 10 years ago. And the pressures are much different than they were before.
And just for listeners, you were talking about Suni Lee and Jade Carey, who won the all-around and then the floor exercise golds. All right. So now, I want to give listeners a heads up, because for the next couple of minutes, we're actually going to raise the issue of sexual abuse. And this could be triggering for some of our listeners. And I want them to know that in advance. This is also a story that involves trauma. We've talked on the show about former Team USA Dr. Larry Nassar abusing more than 100 young girls, including Biles, over the years in working with U.S. gymnastics. And she talked about that back in April with NBC's Hoda Kotb. Here is a bit of what she said.
I just feel like everything that happened, I had to come back to the sport to be a voice, to have change happen, because I feel like if there weren't a remaining survivor in the sport, they would have just brushed it to the side. But since I'm still here and I have quite a social media presence and platform, they have to do something. So I feel like coming back, gymnastics just wasn't the only purpose I was supposed to do.
You came back for that other reason. I didn't know that.
I don't think I knew it either, but I feel like gymnastics wasn't the only thing I was supposed to come back for.
So, Jotham, I mean, you are a licensed therapist, and we are talking about somebody who was using her skill in a professional sport, but as a venue to talk about and bring forward, keep front and center, something significantly traumatizing and profound. And I can't believe that wasn't also incredibly difficult to have that be the context in which you're doing something that is harder than anyone else can do and riskier than anyone else. And I just unpack that for us a little bit.
Yeah, I think it speaks to her mental toughness. I think anyone who questions her mental toughness, you know, at this point, I don't know what to tell people. I mean, to go through what she went through, from a trauma perspective, from an athlete on the top of her game, highest level perspective, from a work that needs to go into getting to that level perspective, all those things require such a level of mental toughness. It's really unbelievable. I think in our field, definition of trauma has really come a long way. I think it's ever expanding. I think we're starting to recognize that you know, trauma and PTSD can come from a lot of different things. It used to be very much a singular definition, you know, a couple decades back, and it's come a long way. And I think trauma-informed care has improved as well. I also think this sort of topic, you know, what she went through and how that ties into what she's going through now, I think it speaks to how mental health still has a stigma, although it's improved. I think this relates to the fact that mental health can be a bit, there's an invisible nature to it. You know, you can't see mental health injuries as easily as physical, and it leads to people on average very much underrating the impact on the person.
So, John, just briefly, the two of you are deeply in touch with local sports culture. You are local podcasters here. What from this is the lesson you think we locally need to learn the most?
I think it's important that we're doing the work that I'm doing with athletes, with everybody. I think, you know, the term that I use is prehab, in terms of like preventative care. We need to be going in, and mental health and physical health have always been seen as these two silos, and it's time that they're unified. And I think that's the push that we've been, you know, Jotham and I have been screaming from rooftops to be able to try to get people to pay attention to that. And it's incredible that we're seeing more and more people. Michael Phelps was on talking about it as well, talking about the importance of this work, and the same amount of resources, the same amount of attention, the same amount of time needs to be going into supporting these kids and these athletes with how to prepare their mind. We train tirelessly in the weight room, lifting and getting muscles ready, and in the pool or in the gymnast facilities or on the track and field. And we do all these different things, and we do not prepare them for the mental stress that's going to go into there. And I think that what we need to be doing is having professionals in the fields doing the direct work, and it needs to happen yesterday.
All right. That is John Cuna and Jotham Busfield, licensed therapists and co-hosts of the Grim Drive podcast, which discusses mental health through the lens of sports. John and Jotham, thank you for spending the time today.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you,
Tiana. All right, folks, that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.